My name is Laura Ramirez, and I am a PhD candidate at UIC. My field is educational policy studies. I also organize with Justicia and Ayotzinapa Comité Chicago, as well as a couple of national organizations. One is called US Tire 2, which is just a network of people across the country that was formed after the disappearance of the students. So all of this stuff is new, right? Like, this just really started in October in terms of us coming together as a community to organize against enforced disappearances, right? And we're speaking about forced disappearances by the state. And I'm sure you watched the movie, so I definitely want to know what your take on that is. But that's why we're here, because we are just people who met at the consulate on October 8th. It was a protest against the disappearance of the students. So just to put this in context, I'm not sure, let me ask you, how many of you have heard a lot about this, or how many of you think that you have a really good context of what happened? Raise your hand. So on September 26th, the night of September 26th to the morning of September 27th, a group of students from Ayotzinapa, these are all first-year students, right? Ayotzinapa is a teacher's college. It's called a normal school, which is a rural school that is actually training teachers from indigenous populations to go back and to their indigenous population or other populations that they get assigned and teach them just basic elementary school stuff, right? And sometimes, so they still have the one-room schoolhouses, right, where you teach anywhere from kindergarten to high school. And most of these populations are non-Spanish-speaking populations. So they're indigenous, native people of origin. There's so many different words that we can use. Most of them do not speak Spanish. So these young teachers are all considered bilingual teachers. And just an interesting story. When I went down there, I spoke with them. And I was like, oh, you're bilingual. And they're like, yeah, Michael, so do you teach English? And they looked at me like, you are so, like, you know, U.S. Americanized, right? And that's when I realized that the context in which I move, right? Bilingual means I speak the tongue of my people, right? Which could be Nahuatl, which could be, there's so many different ones, I can't even begin to mention them, right? But in the community that they're living in, they actually get taught four languages. And they get taught how to read them, they get taught how to write them, and they go back to their communities, and they actually have to live with the people. The conditions of those communities are beyond oppressive, to say the least. I'm sorry?
Where were they kidnapped from?
Guerrero. So Guerrero is the southern state in Mexico, which is, I don't know if you know Oaxaca, it's known for a lot of its beaches. Well, it's down there. It's on the west coast. It's very far south. It's not in the middle. It's about 6 hours south of Mexico City. So they were basically, they live there, right? So these are universities that are supposed to be funded by the state. And the students are taken from their farms. They're all farmers, all of them. And they have to live in the school. They get supported by the government. And the interesting thing that I found is that the budget that they get to eat, to buy supplies, to fix the school, to get water for everything is 40 pesos a day per person, which is the equivalent of $3 a day. And with that money, they're supposed to pay for everything. I'm sorry. Because they live there, right? So it's insane. They were telling me how sometimes all they eat is beans. And even if sometimes they get like a little bowl of beans a day in tortillas, right? Like, so they're living in conditions, even themselves, there are, you know, sometimes inhumane. They don't have hot water. They have to shower with cold water even in winter. And they really sleep in very minimum conditions. So there's a lot in the internet if you want to go and look up the school. It's called Raul Isidro Burgos de Ayotzinapa. And I can write down the name for you so that you can understand it. So that night they went to, because of the conditions that I just mentioned, the way that they raise money is to go and literally stop buses. Now this is the thing. They have already an agreement with the bus companies that they're going to get on. They're going to ask people for money and then they get off. And then they use that money to go back to the school to then fund all their education, right? Which is insane. Why would somebody have to go literally stop public buses to be able to fund a teacher's education? We're not talking about elementary school. We're talking about teachers, right? Which here in the United States, when you have teacher training programs, they cost thousands of dollars, right? And over there, you have these people that are living less than 40 pesos a day, right? $3 a day. So that's the condition. So they have to go into the cities to do boteos. That's what they call it, which is, I don't want to call it begging because it's not begging, but it's nicely asking for money from the population to support them, right? So this night, that's exactly what they did. The reason they needed money is because October 2nd in Mexico is a huge day. is a day when in 1968, the students from the UNAM, which is the biggest university in Latin America, were actually killed at gunpoint, including children, parents, young people. To this day, we still haven't had the exact numbers, but we believe there are thousands of people who got murdered by the military on that day. To this day, it remains in Mexican history one of the most heinous crimes that we've ever witnessed as a population, right? So every October 2nd, the whole country goes back to do protests to Mexico City and still holding the government, trying to hold the government accountable, because 40-something years later, 47 years later, nobody still has paid for that crime, right? And I'm talking about young children, women, students who were actually hunted down like animals for years. So this is why in our country, history is so important. We teach our history to each other, and we constantly remember that. So they were going back to Mexico City to protest for that, right? Part of the training that they get at the school is how to be civically engaged, or how to be engaged in their community and also in the politics of the country. These schools were actually created after the Mexican Revolution. In 1910, the Mexican population rose up for the same reasons that we are living now, which is basically most of our land being sold to foreign corporations, most of the Mexican people, their land being taken away and used by transnational corporations to make money for foreigners. And on top of that, also the fact that Mexicans didn't really have human rights. Well, to this day, we really don't have them, right? And especially the people of origin, indigenous populations in Mexico, they weren't even considered human, right? So a lot of them, since they don't have birth certificates, since they don't have land titles, their land was literally taken away and they were made indentured servants. So for 30 years, we lived, Mexico lived under a dictatorship that we call El Porfiriato, right? Porfirio Diaz was the ruler. 1910, you have Zapata, you have Villa, you have a lot of other insurrections that start the revolution. So by 1917, we created a new constitution. This new constitution prohibited the ownership of land by foreigners, specifically because we knew that every time a foreign power comes into Mexico, our people become enslaved. And that has been historically since the colonization, since 1492, right? Or actually 1502 when Cortes landed in Mexico. So as Mexican people, we understand this history. And we know that it's really important for us to keep our natural resources and our land, because that's just what happens historically. So they were going to Mexico City to protest, and on their way there, the local government, the municipal police, started actually, they stopped them in the street. And according to accounts, and this is where other people please come in, because, you know, this is all what we have heard and what we haven't witnessed it, right? The municipal police that stopped them from moving and started just grabbing students out of the bus and started shooting at the bus. Now, a lot of there were six people that got killed that night. All of them were part of this soccer team, except for one woman who was sitting in her car behind the bus with the students. The other ones were all parts of this team called Los Avispones de Chilpancingo, which was a soccer team that was actually going. They had nothing to do with any of this. They were just on the bus. And one of them was a student. Now, the interesting thing about the student was that he was taken that night, too. Right, so one student was taken with the other 43. So they were taken, and this is where the story becomes very complicated. People have witnesses that said that the military was there to actually help the municipal police take the students. The government refutes this this version. However, it's been proven that the last cell phone message, and this is why I think this film is really interesting, right? When the people who get taken are able to call their parents. Amnesty International was able to trace the last phone call by one of these students to the military, to a military battalion that is located a few miles away from where that happened, right? So even though the government denies any involvement, we have evidence that they were taken into these military quarters, and that was the last place that they were seen. So one of the things about it is that what happens when your military, your municipal government, and your federal police are all just literally taking students, right? These are students. They did not have guns. They did not have any weapons. And actually, one of their sayings is, it's always piedras, stones versus bullets. That's the war, which really reminds me a lot of what's happening in Palestine, right? Even if you think about that, right? Like, what is their power? Their power is they don't have a military. They're not armed. These students, even though they've been tried to be called guerrilleros, which is like leftist warriors, they don't really have access to these weapons, right? So one of the things that we are still pushing for is a clear investigation of the events. that actually take into consideration the proof and the evidence that it has been turned in by the parents, by the people who witnessed, and also by Amnesty International and other Human Rights Watch, which has also investigated, as well as the Argentinian and Swedish forensic evidence that they do have. And none of this has been taken into consideration
and
in the story.
By the United Nations as well.
Yeah, by the, yeah, they also
they
investigated.
Except the governments, you know, what they say.
Yes. Oh, yes. And they did go to Geneva just a couple weeks ago to actually charge the Mexican government with forced disappearances, right? So just to go back a little bit, so basically they were taken and they haven't been seen yet. The one student that I mentioned that was found, the way that he was found is something that's very critical to analyze, and I don't have an answer for this, so this is something that we're still thinking about. He was found with his skin completely peeled off and his eyes taken out. Now, when I mentioned that to people, they said, this is not narcos. The narcos, the people who do this type of warfare with, that comes with the drug trade, they usually decapitate you. They cut off your body parts. They hang you from trees. They have a very specific way to communicate to people, to terrorize the population. They want you to know who did it. They never are shy about letting you know. So when they found this person without his skin, they knew that he had been skinned alive, right? They knew that his eyes had been taken out while he was still living. The proof that we do have is the counterinsurgency measures that were used in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Nicaragua during the dirty wars of the, you know, between the leftists and the right wing. They all represented the same type of warfare, which is the same thing that happened to this young man. When I went to Mexico and met with several people, including human rights activists, their analysis of the situation is, this is not narcos. This is a clear message to the students that they are being, yeah, that's, he has the picture. It's very
you don't
graphic.
Wanna see it, I mean, don't see it, just pass it. But, you know, I wanna just pass it to you. If you wanna say, yeah, I don't wanna see it, that's fine.
It's very
you know,
graphic.
But it's up to you. In my point of view, you need to face reality sometimes to understand it. But if you don't want it.
No, yeah, I already seen it.
Yeah. Okay, if not, you can Google.
Yeah, you can Google it. His name was Juan Carlos Mondragon, and I can write it down for you. So very quickly, when they found this body, one of the analysis of the people on the ground is, this is a message to the left in Mexico. This is a message by right-wing School of the Americas trained counterinsurgency measures that they want you to know that you live in a dictatorship, that this is not a democracy, that you do not have the right to protest, that you do not have the right to stand up, and that you do not have the right to do the things that these students do. I would really suggest that you research a little bit about what they do at that school. It's called the leftist school because it was founded after the revolution to continue that thought, that Mexicans need to preserve their land, that we need to create this indigenous community that is preserved, and also around land rights, human rights, and what it means, which is our ideals around the revolution, right? So the Mexican Revolution is actually very, very important in this understanding. Okay, so I passed this picture up. If you had a picture of a young man called Alexander Venancio, it's actually a color picture, and I passed his on purpose because, yes, they said that they would declare him dead when the Mexican government, the attorney general. Right? So after their investigation, which is called the official history, which is really interesting, they said that he's been declared dead. So for all extents and purposes for the Mexican government, Alexander Venancio is dead. However, when I spoke to the parents, they said no. The only evidence they had was a tooth. They found a tooth, and they found a little fragment of a bone. They're like, how is that evidence? You're telling me that after your official story, where you're telling me that you can incinerate 43 bodies, right? You're going to have a tooth that's completely left by itself. That makes absolutely no sense, right? So even the peritos, which are the forensic evidence people from Argentina, completely deny this. They're like, we cannot, number one, attest to the fact that this body, that this tooth was found in the site that they're saying that the cremation happened. And two, we do not know if the evidence was tampered with, if it was taken from him when he was alive. So there's no real way to know whether or not this person is dead. So when I went to Mexico, to Ayotzinapa, I spoke to the parents, and they said that the father of Alexander had kind of taken a leave of absence because they're trying to figure out, do we want to continue to fight this or do we want to accept their death? After having no more evidence, they decided that they were going to continue to fight, that they do not accept the version of the government, and that they will continue until they have the bodies of the youth. So for them, it's kind of like that movie. They, when they said, you know, I'd rather find a body because at least then I know that I can move on. So the biggest quandary with the parents right now is living day to day with the weight of not knowing whether their children are being tortured, whether their children are being kept somewhere, or whether their children are dead. You know, so it's a very difficult situation for them emotionally, psychologically, and also physically, because they've been living at the school since this happened with the young people. They have not gone home. They only go home to sleep sometimes to get some clothes. What the mothers share with me is that the pain of watching their children's room and their objects sitting there is unbearable. One of the difficult things for them is that they do have other children, and basically they have become almost secondary in this entire thing. One of the young people who got disappeared, I don't remember his name right now, he had actually three children. A lot of these young men actually had families, right? So as we talk about the fathers, we haven't talked about the wives and the brothers. And so there's a lot more people that have been impacted by their disappearance. And not just people that were close to them, their community, right? Because they know that this was a clear message to them about being engaged in any social movement, in anything that raises consciousness. They're basically being terrorized by the state, right? So that's one of the analysis, and I don't have a lot more time. So the last thing I want to kind of mention, and I'm sorry that this is so rushed, is the connection between neoliberalism and what's happening in Mexico, right? As you saw in this film, they really do talk about the corporations that are coming in that need this access to oil, that need access to natural resources, that need access to even vegetables, right? I don't know if you know, but in the United States, most of our fruit and vegetables comes from Mexico. And it's particularly the area that we're talking about, Guerrero, Michoacán, all these that have been ravaged by the drug war that has been happening for the last 8 years. All of these are producing states of some of our lettuces, tomatoes, most of the stuff we get here. If we don't get it from California, we get it from Mexico, right? So it's very important to understand our actual, you know, that we are directly affected by what's happening, right? Because we in some ways consume all these things, including the oil, the silver, the gold. Guerrero is also home to the largest silver mine in the entire world. And not too long ago, they figured out that the location of the school is right on top of some huge gold mines. They actually called it the Gold Triangle because there's so much gold there that there's mining companies, for Canadian mining companies, who have already been basically involved in this, in the actual removing of indigenous people from their land in order to actually mine there. Now, we know that the school is located in one of these spaces, and we also know that one of the biggest dangers to the government is for these young men to go out into the indigenous communities and give them the knowledge, because they are very politicized. They understand neoliberalism. You have a child there that's 6 years old who, will, if you say neoliberalism to them, they will understand what you're talking about. They know what this is. This is the collusion between the governments, allowing transnational corporations, allowing foreign capital, and allowing their sovereignty to be slowly taken away by economic interests, right? And the way that these people live it right now, and I don't know if you ever read this book by David Harvey called Neoliberalism, and if you haven't, I highly suggest that you do, because it really talks about how neoliberalism is not just an economic policy. It's a policy to change the way that you look at yourself in the material world, right? In which you start to look at everything as capital. Human capital, social capital, anything is capital that can be bought and sold in this free market. And the government only exists as far as it allows for capital to flow, meaning that there's no more sovereignty. Mexico is not a sovereign state. It is actually being ruled by the interest of corporations. And we know this, right? Because there's been all these investigations. The president right now, one of the biggest problems that he's having is accounting for his houses that are super rich, right? And we don't know, where is he getting $7 million in a country where people are making $5 a day? That's the minimum wage, you know? So there's a lot here, and, you know, I can't give you all of it, but I have some compañeros that can help us understand other aspects of this. But I definitely would, I want to just extend an invitation to learn more about this. As a committee, we have a lot more things that we're doing to raise awareness, including bringing the parents of some of the disappeared students to Chicago, and we'll talk a little bit more about that if you're interested, having events with them where they can speak to you and everybody about their experience, and it's not being filtered through our analysis, right? So I just want to open it up. Senators and congressmen and give them money in order to pass certain laws and things like that, right? We know that.
The same thing is happening in Mexico, except that not just corporations, but also the narcos are the ones that are basically financially supporting the government, right? So for a long time, they try to make it seem like, oh no, the government's fighting the narcos and they're against each other, and that's why there's this war. Well, another thing that enters the picture is also, which goes back to putting, I think, everything together, is Plan Mexico, or Mérida Initiative, which was actually funded by the United States government in 2008 through Calderon, right? He was the one that was in power in Mexico, and I believe Obama was in power here at that time. So what happened with this initiative, right, actually started with Bush, I believe.
Bush,
right? And then Obama continued it. So Obama has continued to ratify this. But it started with Bush and Calderon. So what happened was that basically because of all the drug trafficking that's been happening, the United States funded $2.3 billion of military, intelligence, training, aid, and information, right, through the School of the Americas, and also through direct investment in weapons, right? So what has happened was that those weapons ended up in the hands of mostly the narcos, and also army and paramilitary. The paramilitaries like the CIFAs, the ones that you were just talking about, people who leave the government and they start their own factions, their own violent factions, vying for power and money. So what was created was basically a civil war between the different types of narcos, right? So the narcos at first started as drug traffickers, then they started having a lot of money and started getting into the government. A lot of the government officials, including congressmen, we know they're being supported directly or are part of the families, the different families that are running the drug war. So where this comes in handy, right, is because you want to continue, number one, you want to terrorize your state, right? In order to have a servile people, they need to be afraid. And this comes all the way from Machiavelli, right, the prince. We know that we want a population that's in fear. We know that we also want to give them no alternative, which is where neoliberalism comes in, right? Regardless of how much capitalism is screwing you over, you're going to go with it because you don't have an alternative, right? And number three, you also want to make people believe the story of the government, right? You want to make them believe that the government is actually trying to fight this conflict and that they're on the side of the people. So where it all kind of collides is in the fact that these students are considered, they say this and the government will say this, the seeds of consciousness. They are some of the few people in Mexico who still have that consciousness around what does it mean to be free, what does it mean to have a different lifestyle that's indigenous-based, that's not fully capitalist, right? What does it mean to actually believe in the revolutionary ideals of our country and not in this neoliberal state that we've been sold? And the last piece is also that we have the power, that through people power, that through organizing, that through direct action, we can directly fight against the government. So these three ideas that you hear from these students are in direct collision with what the government wants the general people to believe. Now we know this. There's about 17 normal schools around the country. Not all of them are leftist, not all of them are radical, but the one in Guerrero is the one that maintains all the other ones alive, right? So one of the things is a direct attack on education, right? The same thing we're seeing here, but without that much violence, direct violence, right? You want to take the education system. Why? Because that is how you start to disseminate the ideas of the people for the next generations, right? They want our country to be servile. They want our country to be easily dominated. And they want us to believe that there's no alternative. So all of these forces work together to create this social imaginary around what is possible. And because they are offering options, they are giving us alternatives, they are very dangerous, right? So that's, I don't know if I answered the whole question.
That's really helping. You call it the what spirit?
Revolutionary spirit?
Which one? Revolutionary.
Exactly what the students were doing by doing more of it.
You mean by the people?
By the people.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's one of the things that I hope my camaradas can talk about, which is the amount of social protests that have actually arisen from this this issue, right? So I don't know. I know that U.S. media is very limited in what it allows you to see, but it's been, they're calling it the biggest uprising since the 1960s, right, when the students got killed, and even actually since the Mexican Revolution, because the uprising in the 60s was limited to students. And this uprising has taken over all of civil society. What's very interesting is that there's many different layers to this uprising. You have people on the streets, like just general people, mothers, children, just people who are tired. And that's why that whole hashtag was so popular, Ya Me Cansé, means I am tired. tired. They're tired of living in terror. They're tired of living in poverty. They're tired of living in absolute corruption and repression and lack of freedom, right? So that's one piece. And the other piece is also the students. There's been a direct attack on public education through the Educational Reform Act of 2013, which, interestingly enough, is actually modeled after Renaissance 2010, the same policy in Chicago that closed over 150 schools. So the policy that started in Chicago was then made national through Race to the Top, and then it was exported to Mexico under the Educational Reform Act of 2013, which calls for the privatization of education, teacher evaluations, the standardization of education, and the punishing of schools that don't meet standards, right? So all of this is all together, right? So what happened with the students, it just blew the keg open, right? And many people have that same question, why these students? We don't know. But what we do know is that Mexican society is extremely tired of living under this terror state and that they're not taking it anymore.
My name is Manuel Revueltas. Yeah, I'm working with the committee too. And this is when we came out. Immediately that we noticed here in Chicago, well, immediately that we noticed that it happened in Mexico, we started to organize here locally in Chicago, a group of people. And just, let's say, spontaneously, we just got it outside of the consulate, which is the main place of our government. They have a representation, and we start to make a process. That was really spontaneous. That was 4 months ago. And we start to doing it little by little by little by little. I mean, I think the role of the Mexican-Americans that they gotta have to do with Mexico in the future is going to be more in politics. What I'm glad is Mexican-Americans, or our group, or many groups around the country, they are start to be focused not just on economics or immigration or culture. I mean, we are starting to put some questions in the foreign policy, in U.S. foreign policy, which is really important. It's another, let's say, another thing that we, or the government, or in U.S., they didn't think that we are probably going to be involved or interested in foreign policy. Well, yeah, it's important foreign policy because it's affecting not just Middle East, but it's affecting Mexico and it's affecting Latin America as well. Then we start to doing this protest. We start really 2 or 3 people, and then it comes in a really powerful process in January 6th when Enrique Peña Nieto, he came to visit Obama in Washington, D.C. There was around 400 people. And I got to mention there was 400 people gathered all together and spontaneously. And I got to mention something. I mean, there was a spontaneously manifestation, a spontaneous process, but many of the local or national leaders that you know from the Latino or Mexican-American community, well, nobody was there. Joe mentioned a Latino caucus. They haven't expressed any concern, solidarity. You mentioned immigration leaders. They haven't expressed any concern or solidarity. You mentioned any local small federations or groups. They haven't expressed any solidarity. Then pretty much there was nobody expressing solidarity. Just this group of local peoples in every single city that spontaneously came out. For me, that was, hey, something is happening here. Or nobody wants us to touch this issue, the issue of not just the students, but the issue of the Plan Mexico, the issue of what is the role of the U.S. Is taking care in terms of sending weapons to Mexico, legally or illegally. The issue to see what is the responsibility of the U.S. in terms of the country who's demand drugs, right? Then what is the responsibility? I mean, all these things are coming together in Guerrero. Because in Guerrero, the issue is not just the 43 students. I mean, in Guerrero, what happened is the 43 students is just a part of the whole pot mixture all together. What else is coming over there? What else is coming? Mass extermination, of course, to the 43 students. There is coming corruption at local, national level. Is coming drug dealers, cartels, local drug dealers as well, that they are fighting all together. They are coming, what else? They are coming corporations as well. They are coming, what else? Mines. They are coming mines. There's in the time when Calderon was a president, there was He gave a 20,000 concessions for mines. What is telling us this to us is telling us that there's 20,000 places where these mines can explode, go and explode and work on those mines. But the problem is around the mines, there's a population around there. That we are talking about is a 20,000 places with potentially going to have an impact in communities. And what happened with the communities? How are they going to react? They're gonna stand up and try to fight these mines, or they're gonna have an agreement with them, or how they wanna regulate these mines. Mostly, I think most of the people in Mexico, they're already not happy, and probably I think mostly, not everybody, but a large percent is probably gonna be interested to fight back those mines and those places. And we are talking 20,000 places, potentially places. Around the area, there are communities, mestizos, people like me, indigenous people as well, and probably some places that nobody live. I mean, but still they are taking out, you know, natural resources. Now, this 20,000 concession, how was it happen? Well, 2-3 weeks before Calderon, he was finished his presidency, he just give it away, the 20,000 concessions. I mean, just like 2 weeks before, boom, it's gone. I mean, it's incredible because he didn't ask nobody to, he didn't ask for a transparency of giving the concessions to the best parties or something like that. I mean, he just, in an urgency to give it away. Just give it away to whatever, whatever who can give it the best, you know, money for those concessions. No? Then we started. Immediately we noticed that we happened, we started. And as I mentioned before, local leaders, national, Latino, or Mexican-Americans, of course, they didn't show up any solidarity. The consulate in Mexico, of course, they didn't show up any solidarity. We haven't asked the authorities when they come in here or in the consulate that they open a public forum with the community here in Chicago. They deny it. And this is where we're coming in this picture. In our point of view, I think what we are calling state or government state, you know, I think we see it like an octopus, and even the tentacles reach here in Chicago. I mean, here in Chicago, we have a large population of Mexicans. Some people of Mexico, Mexican Americans, they have a wealthy business. You have a really good supermarket. You have a business all the time. But as well, there's a good supply of drugs in Chicago. Then we think some of these issues, they are touching hot spots, and they prefer to be aware, you know, away. Because we are talking about, the people who kidnapped the students, there was a local police in conjunction with a local drug dealers. And by the way, these local drug dealers, Chicago is one of their main places where they send drugs. Mm-hmm. Then, exactly an answer why? That's a good question to ask them. For example, local reps, ask immigration leaders, why they don't support us. And another reason why is because this case, the Ayotzinapa, is moving the underground, you know, politics in Mexico. I mean, they are putting in question if the government really is working in favor of the people. I mean, I remember, you know, I have a friends and they ask me all the time, hey, what happened in Mexico? Why they cannot get the full potential? And primarily my first answer was, it's because of the government. And I was thinking that was a smart answer. But we didn't get, you know, understand how deeply the government, they are not letting us to fill our full potential. At this point, I think the government is not just one of the reasons why we cannot get our full potential, but it's our enemy as well. I mean, that becomes an enemy. It's not even in our side. It's an enemy. We have been asking the consulate, at least give us a chance to the people to open, have a forum, and talk about it. Because the people, they want to know it. No, they just told us, you know what? You just came, can come three people. Say, no, we want to come 20. No, well, the community, no, just I have a contact with the media, and that's it.
My name is Donatio Ayala. We work together with the committee once in a while. One of the most important things that you have to understand is that what happened in Mexico about the disappearance, everything is all is connected, right? And one of the things that we've been investigating is the point that how the narco traffic is into the government. What I try to say is like the narcs get into the government and they get together now, all right? It's not the authorities fighting against the narc or the narcos. It's more like they're working together in one solidarity against the people. And one of the most, one of the points that you can see that is the taking advantage of the indigenous people, taking their land, because the transnational companies wants to establish over there, right? And we're talking about, the compañera here and the compañero, they talk about the mines, but it's also another kind of infrastructure, right? It's the drug, how do you call it? The drug trade, but also is they're fighting for who is having the most drug in selling, right? So all the controlling, yeah. There are different groups, different cartels. They're fighting against each other for controlling who sells more drugs, right? And in the way to do that, they are fighting where the people is living. My whole point is that yes, the disappearing of the students and the disappearing of these people that you saw in the documentary is all related to the same point. They don't disappear just because they were in a bad guys or they were in the wrong place in the wrong time. No, this is a common thing that is happening because they want to disappear the people. Bottom line, okay? The transnationals already bought the land. They already bought the land through the government. The government sell the land. I buy the piece of land, but there's people there. What I'm gonna do? Well, it's not my problem. It's your problem. You sell me the land, you get rid of them. So they use the government is using the narco traffic, the narcs, as a group of people who paramilitaries to remove the people who live there. Guerrero is now is the most hot place in that way because of the gold mines, because of the tourism, because of the what happened with Ayotzinapa, but everything goes to one point, the power. Who has more power is who rules, right? So these people is in resistance. The people, the indigenous people is in resistance. And that has to be clear for you, for everybody. They are in resistance and they want our support. We need to support them because if we leave them alone, they're gonna disappear.
And soon, I just want to go back to the parents coming to Chicago. So we are, it's called Caravan with an A, Caravana 43. The whole point is that it's uniting a lot of people in Chicago to come together and really welcome them. So we want to invite you to be actually, you know, part of these events and attend them. So if you can put your name and information on this list, we'll definitely invite you. Next month, approximately in the middle of the month, so we do have some sort of timeline, but it's not set because, as our compañera Roxana was talking about, these are people who don't necessarily belong to the Republic, meaning they don't have birth certificates. They don't even really are part of the, they don't have a formal education. A lot of them, their Spanish is their second language, so they don't even read and write in Spanish, right? So there's all these barriers. All these students were indigenous. All their parents are indigenous, right? Some of them don't speak any Spanish. So there's a lot of barriers in terms of them even getting here. So we've been working on this since November. That's how long it took them to find their birth certificates. Barely 2 weeks ago, they were able to apply for visas, humanitarian visas. So we're waiting right now to hear if whether or not they're going to be given visas. Once we know,
we will have the dates. So they're going through a caravan throughout the United States. Right now it's between 20 and 30 cities that they're trying to visit in a span of a month. Their goal is to get to the United Nations in New York and actually speak to the United Nations. And the other one is the Organization of American States for there to be an investigation in Mexico, which we know, you know.
So the parents want to come tell their story, right? They understand that the story, that the United States is critical for them. Why? Because number one, we're funding them. We're funding the terrorist state, right, through the Plan Merida. So we are the main culprits in terms of the violence, including the transnational corporations. So that's one. Number two, they want everybody here to hear their stories from their own mouths, right? They know that what we hear is really being filtered through social media, through people's experiences, through what people want to say about them. They want to personally come and tell you their story. And the third one, they believe that the United Nations is a way to actually indict the entire system, right? Which is going back to it was the state there. And we understand as people in the United States that the United Nations are complicated and complex and they're not necessarily the good guys that people think they are, but at the same time they see themselves as having no more recourse, right? Who are they supposed to go to for justice when your state fails?
No,
right,
that's right. I mean, some of them went to Europe, like to
mm-hmm.
the European
Geneva
parliament, and next week or 2 weeks from now the people from the parliament is coming to Mexico. Well, it's going to Mexico.
Yes.
And well, it's part of the discussion about this decolonization process.
Yeah.
Why go to the UN? You know that it's part of the problem, right?
I don't know. I think because they're using this understanding of human rights again, right? So I think, and you know, I don't know if Roxana wants to add to that.
It's one of those secret words that sometimes we don't want to mention too much or go deep into, like the same other word, like a God or mom or dad or government. We touch the government, but we don't. Keep an ask, a question mark on it. We don't go deep into. But these guys, they are starting to do, 14 municipalities. They come by themselves autonomous of people, non-political parties, just regular people, people with moral, moral leaders. Basically, I call in, we don't need the parties anymore. I mean, the political system, it doesn't work. The political parties doesn't work anymore. Not necessarily because it's really bad, the concept is because there's not enough conditions. I mean, all the people that is in all the system that rule the political parties is all corrupted. Then pretty much you need to wipe out and start over, like what they are doing in Guerrero with the 14 municipalities. Start over again. I mean, it's start in some places in Mexico, it's a start from zero. Start over. Start by yourself. Imagine what kind of government do you want it. 2 people, 3 people, 12 people. This year is the fourth year. There was in a place in Michoacán that is called Cherán. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much one of the first efforts to have it a autonomy in Mexico. Los Zapatistas. This is the fourth year anniversary that they started to be autonomous, this small place in Michoacán. And basically what they do is they divided, 12 people. They said, well, we have an assembly and you're going to be the leader for January, me for February, March. The options is unlimited. It could be still to be 12, it could be 5, it could be, I think it's that, the... it's unlimited, the plants, but there are some efforts.
It's important that the idea of indigenous people remains, because this is allowed under the Mexican Constitution for indigenous people to actually have their own government, to be autonomous, right? If you take away their language, their culture, their understanding of that law, they can no longer do that. That's why it's possible, right? Because they have that right under the Constitution, which... unfortunately, the Constitution has already been changed like 5 times in the last 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. So that's under the autonomy of indigenous people, which if you know, there's 3 million indigenous people in Mexico. A lot of them don't even speak Spanish, right? So it's important to understand that it's not just us, the mestizos, who speak Spanish. there's a large population of people who don't have access to you or to this kind of conversation because they're kept out, because they're not given education, health, or even the rights to the land that they own, right? So it's a complicated thing, yeah, but the Constituyente is something that's been happening, and we're really excited. Hopefully it will happen, but they are boycotting the elections in June.